intoxicated to the point we won't be in control and something bad might happen. It's difficult to explain to him that for some adults it's normal to have a glass or two of wine together of an evening. I'm used to this now. It's been almost 3 years, but at the start it felt like a battle I would never win. I would arrive to work late with puffy eyes because I just felt I couldn't cope and I'd sob the whole way in. Evenings were now a rush of clubs, cooking tea, cleaning up, baths, sorting uniforms for the next day and making packed lunches. It just seemed so hard at times. I was drained. But then I would watch Isaac and Tallulah giggling so much together that they were in physical pain. Or I heard Edie refer to Seb as her big brother when she kissed him goodnight. Or one of the boys would just love me. They would just come over while I was cooking their tea or folding their clean washing and wrap their arms around me for no reason at all, and I remembered that's why we were doing it. I knew then why we were exhausted and worn out and skint, because we hoped that one day we would have five adults that would look back and remember a childhood that wasn't perfect, but know that they were loved unconditionally, and even when we got things wrong, they would know we were trying our absolute hardest to get them right. That's why we have a crazy house, I suppose. I don't really go out, so I bring everyone here, and I never want any child to feel unwanted or unloved. My nieces and nephews are treated like my own children and are more like siblings to my kids. The girls' friends are always here, and for some reason, our house is the one where the whole neighbourhood likes to hang out. The boys had to get used to a chaos they'd never known before, as did their daddy, but it's a good chaos. It's a chaos in a home that's full of love, one where my friends let themselves in and put the kettle on and fold the laundry if I'm not home from work. One where their kids grab food from the cupboard or fridge and put the TV on even if my kids aren't home. It's a chaos that I created because of my own childhood, where I craved having a friend over but wasn't allowed. I remember lying in bed promising that when I grew up my house would be full of love and busy with people, and that's what I've got, and it's something that I never ever want to stop. Recently, Betsy's friend turned up, having climbed out of her bedroom window while she was grounded. I answered the door to her as she was sobbing, and I told her Betsy was at gym, but I invited her in for a cuppa and a chat. While drinking that tea and eating a pack of chocolate hobnobs between us, she took me straight back to my teenage years when she was trying to explain her feelings. Where life right then seems so unfair, where parents are arseholes who don't understand you and think you're lying even when you're not. I got it, but now I'm the parent. I also get how we live in fear that our kids are lying and getting into situations they don't need to be in. As I gave her a hug and wiped her tears, I reminded her that her dad does love her, even though she's convinced he doesn't. He just wants to protect her and keep her safe and tiny forever. It's so hard for a teenager to see it like it is. Secondary school is really such a small part of your life, and it has such a small impact on you once you get into the big wide world, where you might go on to university, choose a career, have babies, meet your future partner. But while you're in that secondary school, it swallows you up. It is the be-all and end-all in everything, and it's impossible to see life after it. I suppose with Betsy I'm quite lenient, or maybe I'm trusting. I allow her to go out with her friends, I rarely ground her, and today it's been fine. She's generally a good kid. She is the youngest in her year, as her birthday's in August. Some of her friends are 11 months older, and some in the school year above her are 2 years older, so it feels like she has a huge age gap behind her friends, and it means, because of what they're experiencing, I need her to be totally honest with me. I'm not stupid and I don't turn a blind eye. At the age of 14, I was doing things and getting into situations that now, as a mother, make me shudder at how it might have turned out. I look back and I think that I had zero guidance or support. I had no responsible adult that I could talk to honestly or seek advice from, so I make sure that my kids and their friends will always have that. They'll always have me. I don't threaten Betsy that if I catch her drinking alcohol, I will give her the worst punishments that will make her feel like her life has ended. Instead, I explain the consequences. I make sure she reads the news articles where teenagers have got drunk and lost their lives because of their actions. I explain the difference in having a few sips of an alco pop to look cool in front of your friends, but still have total control of your decisions and actions, compared to downing a litre bottle of Smirnoff and having no idea what is going on around you. When she tells me about the girls in her year who are sexually active, I won't slag them off or badmouth them, because that approach doesn't help anyone. No good will ever come from that at all. It isn't my place to judge or comment on any teenage girl who is choosing to have underage sex. But I can ensure that Betsy knows the dangers, the precautions, and I make sure if she is comfortable enough to do it, then she passes this on to her other friends who may not, for whatever reason, be getting informed of them themselves. I explain how getting a bad reputation sticks with you and can be bad for your state of mind. I've explained safe sex, and we've looked at every STD known to man on the internet and Googled the images so she understands how gross sex is when you're not ready or responsible enough to be having it. And that's all I can do. I'm not the parent that just hopes my kids stay on the straight and narrow. I'm not the parent that naively believes that my children will make good choices and decisions because they've been raised well. I'm not that parent because once upon a time I was the teenager who lied and stole and begged and borrowed. I was manipulative. At times I was full of hate and anger towards the people who didn't deserve it. And despite me coming from a background opposite to what my girls have now, some of the friends I hung out with had the most privileged backgrounds. Some got dropped to school in a brand new limited edition Range Rover and lived in mansions. Some had mums and dads that I dreamed of having, but they still took illegal drugs, drank alcohol and had underage sex. They still lied to their parents and they still made mistakes, which is why I'm a firm believer that talking to your children, educating them and making sure they know you're there for them is vital in helping them get through the most difficult years of their lives, no matter what their background or situation is. Learning to live together is important, and I'm happy that my patchwork family home is now full of love and a lot of chaos. It's always a work in progress, but from my experience, the following things help. Stick together with your partner when you're fighting the world. Try to see each other's points of view, and when you can't, try not to fall out. If he isn't as strong as you want him to be with his ex-partner, who you feel is ruining your life, try to see why. And if she has been an emotional wreck 24/7, understand her reasons. Life is hard when the world is against you, but it's even harder if you're battling the only person who's on your side. Children don't ask to be born. They don't choose their parents or their situations, and they're just tiny versions of us. At times, we struggle to contain our emotions or stop our anger, so how are they meant to? If they've watched their parents go through a split, if they're meeting your new partner, it's hard. Because change is hard. They might become withdrawn, moody or angry, but you need to allow that. Allow them to express their feelings and just be there to love them, no matter how much they test you, because they're doing it to make sure they're safe. Deep down, all children want is to be loved. I watch. It's something I always do. I observe, and although my way of raising a teenager isn't everyone's cup of tea, I think, today, we're getting it right. Keeping your daughter locked away from dangers like teenage boys and alcohol and walking the streets may work for a while, but teenagers are inquisitive and they like to rebel. They also don't open up and tell the truth when they know that the consequences will be punishments for their foolish actions. And teenagers will be foolish most of the time. So if you can, try and just stay calm. Remember, you were young once, and just be there for them to come to you when they've messed up. Chapter 12. Fighting the Good Fight. Josh and I decided to come off Facebook at the beginning of 2016. It had brought us so much negativity by the things that had been written and spread that we had stopped using it anyway. I sent one last post before I closed my personal account. It was the Sheldon Bridge post to Spotted Torquay. Within hours, things went crazy, so I decided to start up my own blog. The page gained around 200 followers within the first week, and it stayed like that for a few months, gaining around 50 to 100 followers each week. There were days I panicked about what people thought of me, what they were saying and commenting, and I began spending my time worrying about people hating me for the blog. One day, I'd had a really bad time and I was thinking about deactivating the page. Josh said, "Why don't you write about it instead and explain how shit things have been?" So I did. I wrote it that night and then went to bed. This was the post. "We are only into day 4 of back to school and I've been a shit mum repeatedly since Monday. This week's epic fuck-ups have included leaving 2 coats worth 60 quid on the pavement because I was too busy trying to convince a 3-year-old it's okay to piss in a bush before we got back in the car. I remembered the next morning on the school run when we were getting bruised from the hailstones and I couldn't find them. Had the morning from hell psyching Tallulah up for our swimming lesson at school where she cried, hyperventilating sobs where she nearly hurled into her Weetabix, from 7:15 until 9:55 that she didn't want to go, only to get there and be told that her lessons don't actually start until May. I gave Betsy no dinner money, but only remembered at 2 o'clock in the afternoon when I was gorging my own lunch at my desk, so I had a meltdown that she would either starve to death or be bullied for being poor. Felt extra punctual and got the kids to school nice and early today, to remember on arriving that I'd totally forgotten to collect my nephew on the way as promised. I've done my usual, felt guilt, a load of rage, and the usual feeling of being a totally shit parent. But then I thought, a shit parent doesn't discipline their daughter before school for being an absolute horror and then burst into tears in the car the minute you've watched her walk through the school gates because you think you were too hard on her, and meanwhile, she doesn't give it a second thought for the rest of the day. Shit parents don't stand in the rain, in the freezing cold through winter every Sunday morning to watch their son play football, then reassure him how amazing he was for the whole journey home, despite him throwing a horrific tantrum because he didn't score enough goals whilst he's covering your clean car in mud. A shit parent doesn't feel like they're failing because they've not read their child's schoolbook every night of the week or practiced their spellings, and there's a chance they could have done better in that test if you had. A shit parent doesn't sit in a meeting with a lump in their throat because they just couldn't get the time off work to wear a high-vis vest and help out on the school trip to the zoo. Shit parents don't feel shame because their kids have eaten McDonald's on a weeknight because they were just too exhausted to even think about what to cook for tea, let alone make it. All these things that make you feel like you're being a shit parent actually means that you're an amazing parent, because you're doubting yourself. Shit parents don't doubt themselves. I've decided it's actually okay whether your kids are full of chicken nugget Happy Meals or roast dinner and veg. It doesn't really matter whether they know the difference between there, there, or there. They will learn. Remember, they needed that telling off before school. They'll thank you for it later when they have their own house, and hopefully, they won't leave their dirty laundry and dishes lying all over the place. One day, when he grows up to be a father himself, coaching his son on a Sunday morning, he will remember that it was you who stood on his sideline. So this afternoon I finished work. I collected my kids. One of them then managed to put their foot through the largest pot of double cream in the back of the car. I drove straight to have it cleaned. I then had to try and explain to the guy, who spoke absolutely no English, that I had no money and try and make him understand that I'd return after I'd been to the cash point. He looked like he wanted to end his life after looking inside the car, and I had my usual lump of, I'm about to cry with anger because my life is so shit, in my throat. Instead of losing my shit, which I was on the verge of doing, I just thought, fuck it. And I took my babies to the cafe where we ate massive ice creams just before tea. As I sat there with my double honeycomb sugar waffle beast with a flake, I decided, so fucking what that my car's going to smell of sour cream for the rest of the year? So what that it's been another week of kid drama? As long as our babies are fed, clean, loved and happy, and not the spawn of Satan most of the time, we must be doing something right, so let's not be so hard on ourselves. I woke up the next day and I had 80,000 new followers. It was at that point I think I realised I wasn't the only parent who struggled. I wasn't the only one who felt like headbutting the steering wheel within minutes of picking up my kids from school, and I wasn't the one who sometimes felt I just couldn't do it. There were thousands of us, hundreds of thousands of parents struggling to cope at times. Most of these parents sent messages to my inbox as they didn't want to publicly comment in case their friends or family members saw and judged them. It was at that point I decided I was going to just blog honestly about how fucking hard life can be. The blog continued to grow, and around June 2017, after several chats with Josh and rewording the post several hundred times, I decided to take a risk and write an open letter to a mum that I was witnessing being subjected to domestic violence. I was passing our house most evenings after collecting Edie from the childminder, and one night, I witnessed a horrific incident where her husband or partner was trying to break into her house and attack her. When I saw her, it took me back to where I was all those years ago. I remembered how one time we got a letter through the door. Tony picked it up off the mat and it was addressed to the wife beater. It was a letter from our neighbours who said they were sick of listening to him and that he needed help. It said he was lucky his wife stuck around after how they had heard him behaving to me. He tore the letter into tiny squares and then he walked out into the street and sprinkled it all over the road while shouting as loud as he could about how people should mind their own fucking business. I died a little inside that day, knowing that my neighbours knew what was going on. I was also ashamed that they knew that I'd stayed despite what my children were hearing and seeing. As soon as I thought back to that day, I decided I had to help this lady. I called the police and children's services, but the man remained at the house. This was my open letter. Dear petite, pretty lady with the dark long hair, I first noticed your house last year when I was driving past with one of my children. You have a wooden and glass porch with another door behind it. There is a window to the right of the door, which I've decided is the lounge, and two upstairs windows. I pass your house at least 4 times a week on my commute home from our childminders. I now pass it more just to check on you. I noticed your house because we thought there was a man trying to break in. My child noticed it before me. He was smashing your porch glass with his fist and shouting in a fit of rage. It was only when I slowed my car down to look closer that I saw you and your two children behind the inside front door, screaming and crying. I wound down my window and I heard him shouting the most horrific threats at you. I immediately panicked and pulled my car up into the pavement. An older man stood on the pavement told me he was calling 999. I reassured my children there was nothing to worry about and we drove home. The next day, I drove past your house with all of my children and saw you walking home. You were pushing your toddler son on his trike and your daughter was holding your other hand. The left of your face was black and blue with bruising. Your eye was closed over and you had cuts to your chin. Your head was bowed towards the pavement. I felt sick. A few weeks later when I drove past again with my children, we saw you walking away from your house. Your daughter was running ahead. With one hand you were pushing your son's trike and the other hand was holding his. Your bruises had faded and you were smiling. I felt sad. I reassured my children there was nothing to worry about and we drove home. The next week, I drove past with my eldest daughter and I saw your little girl in her pyjamas sat on the top step outside your house crying. It was freezing cold. I turned my car around and parked. I pretended I was just a pedestrian and when I walked past, I asked her in a whisper if she was okay. She didn't answer me. She just nodded her head in between sobs to confirm she was, and she ran in the house and shut the porch door behind her. Only she left the inside door open so I could hear him shouting and you screaming, begging him to stop. Your toddler son was sat in the window. He seemed to have no expression on his face. He was just looking out towards the traffic. I felt sick again. I called 999 and I told them what I'd seen. I called children's services the following morning and I wrote a letter. I then got back to my car and reassured my daughter that there was nothing to worry about and we drove home. I've since passed your house often. For weeks I see nothing. Sometimes all the curtains are shut in the daytime for days. I worry you're not okay. Sometimes you are outside sat on the step with your children and sometimes he is there. I've seen you since with more bruises to your face. I have pulled the car up several times and I just wait while pretending to write a report or make a call, hoping that you're left alone and I can quickly run over and slip you my number on some paper so I can help you, but you're never alone and I'm scared of your response. You may not want my help. Last week when I passed, he was down the road. I had to stop at the shop close by, so I pulled up and I studied him with the car window open. I don't know why, I just felt I had to. He made me feel so many things at once. Sickness, rage and utter disgust. He was throwing your son in the air. If I'd have never seen him before, I'd have thought it was so cute. I'd have thought he was one of the dads that the world needed more of. Your son was squealing in delight, more daddy, and it looked like the perfect scene, only it wasn't. Really, it's horrific. This baby boy is in awe of a man who is abusing his mummy, his sister, and him. What is that teaching him? Your children look clean, they look well fed, and they're dressed really trendy and immaculately, always. I often hope that I'll see them in their uniform so I can see what school they attend and I can help you there, away from him maybe. But part of me thinks you'll think I'm crazy, and I question if I am being. I don't know what I would do if a total stranger approached me knowing details of my life. I talk about you often to my friends and family. I think about you and your babies every night before I fall asleep, and I worry for you every morning when I wake up. I wonder if there's a chance that maybe you haven't woken up. And if you haven't, whether I should have done more. I feel angry at you too sometimes that you stay in that situation, that you're not leaving to protect yourself and your babies, but then I feel a horrendous guilt. I have no idea of your situation, your support network or anything else you're going through. Who am I to judge? My children often ask about you and I lie. I lie to protect them, that things aren't as they look, and actually you're fine. I tell them that your babies are happy, and he is probably a very nice man. I then question myself, am I wrong to do that? Should I tell them the truth that I think this man is beating the crap out of you and your children are witnessing it? This could be happening to the girl they pick as their partner in PE or the boy that they play bulldog with at lunchtime. Should I make them aware that this abuse goes on in the world every single day? That then makes me livid with him that there are men and women who make me have to ask myself these questions and leave me not knowing how best to protect my own children because of the abuse they make others endure. I frustrate myself at home. My fiancé is a police officer, and when I rant at him, he reels off the statistics at me. I know that he's attended incidents where people have been left so badly beaten by their partners they have broken bones and are left unrecognisable, yet they still lie to him for their abusers, and they are adamant they just fell down the stairs by accident. Even when they have their own children witnessing it, they go back for more, time and time again. Sometimes, he wins, and charges get pressed against the abusers without statements from the victims and they get brought to justice, but sometimes they don't, and I know some things he's seen break him a little inside too. Then I question, whose job is it to help? Why is nobody helping you, or are you refusing help? Are you convincing the agencies that you're okay? I've written and deleted this post so many times, for the fear of it somehow reaching your partner and your life possibly worsening in some way. Then I think of printing it off and posting it to you when he's not home in the hope I can help you. I have stopped myself from knocking on your door so many times when he is home and letting him know that I think he's a hideous human being who's destroying his children's whole future and ruining your life. What this situation shows me most is how extraordinary it is that once again, somebody has made such a huge impact on my life, yet you have no idea I even exist. I won't stop checking on you and your children, and I won't stop calling the correct authorities when I witness his abuse. And maybe this post will reach you, and actually, instead of it destroying your life, it might just make it better, which in turn means, when I pass you in the street, I won't be lying to my children when I tell them everything is fine, and then I will go to sleep at night without my heart hurting for you. Sending you so much love. Within 24 hours of writing that post, I had so many inbox messages I couldn't keep up. I was being contacted by domestic abuse support services and women's refuges all over the country, asking if they could print and share my post. I realised that domestic abuse was such a huge issue within the UK, and it touched me more than anything else that I had been involved with, so I knew that I had to help. As the messages continued to pour in, I started wondering how I could help these services. Yes, I had a platform to raise awareness, but I wanted to do more than that. I wanted to help change lives. I sat and thought about the best way I could do things. I decided to begin by going back and personally thanking the women who had helped me at the refuge I lived in Exeter. I went online and I called them. I was informed that due to government cuts, the refuge had been closed down in 2014. I arranged to meet the team at Stop Abuse for Everyone, SAFE, which was now a support service that they had set up when they had lost their refuge. I spoke to Jacinta, the managing director, and I was heartbroken to hear how much of her job role was spent fighting for the funds to just stay open. She had lost many of her staff because they couldn't afford to keep them on, and the government was continuing to make more and more cuts while the problem of domestic abuse was continuing to worsen. I asked her what her service needed, and she said they were desperate for craft items, which they used for trauma play therapy for the children who had been subjected to domestic abuse. Craft items. I shared their Amazon wishlist on my page and I asked for support in buying gifts to enable the staff to continue to work with these warrior children. The number of parcels SAFE received was beyond anything we could have imagined. They were running out of space to store them and they kept on flooding in. It was such a nice thing seeing the impact of social media in real life. After that, I knew I could help to make an actual difference and I began to think of other things to do. I decided to sell personalised calendars with pictures and quotes and some of the stories of what the page has achieved. I gave a chunk of the profit to different organisations, SAFE being one of them, and they were so grateful. We stayed in touch, and a few months later, I went on a course to train to do volunteer work for their service. Some parts of the course were harrowing, the videos we watched replayed in my dreams, and the stories we were told by the amazing training facilitator made me see this is what I wanted. This was what I was here to do, to make a change for people's worlds that were being ruined by domestic violence. We watched a video of one mum who, upon leaving her husband, had been frightened for her life. The police said repeatedly that they would speak to him and they didn't. One night, a few weeks later, he broke into her home and he killed her. He then hung her on her own staircase in front of his tiny sons to make it look like she had committed suicide. He then instructed his sons to call their maternal grandma once he had left and tell her that they had found their mummy who had killed herself. That story devastated me. I watched our totally broken elderly parents try and tell our story, how they had been let down by the police and how our sons were now being raised by their uncle and aunt because their father murdered their mother. I watched them explain that they had agreed to make this video to raise awareness for others. I found out that when you are about to leave or have left a domestic abuse relationship, you are at your most vulnerable. You are at the biggest risk from being murdered. At the time of writing, 2 women a week in our country are killed by a current or ex-partner. I found out so much about domestic abuse that I didn't know, even though I had experienced it. I receive regular emails from SAFE with updates on their cases or asking me for help to raise funds through my page. The people who follow my page have donated so much to so many organisations that they have truly changed the lives of so many others, especially warriors and their children who are fleeing domestic abuse. I continue to help, but it takes a lot of my time, and when it all becomes too much, I have to remember that I am only one person. I get up an hour earlier each morning to go through new messages and check on the warriors that I am supporting, and I stay up much later than I should at night doing the same. I am told by professionals I need more boundaries, I need to switch off. But the main problem with domestic abuse is these people have no one, and the violence and control is so ingrained in them that they fear if they contact the police or children's services, they will lose their children. They genuinely believe this, so they come to me because I am the safe option. I sit in a little area where they know I'm not going to remove their children or give them a criminal record. I need to try and undo all the damage that the perpetrator does. I need to be available to give them support, advice, and reassurance. I need to ensure that they speak up and get the help, because if I do switch off and I miss a message, it really could be a matter of life or death. I also want to raise awareness of domestic violence. That's something I can definitely do through the page, and it's part of the reason I'm writing this book. Some people who haven't experienced domestic abuse believe that it only goes on between people who have issues, people who are within the care system, on benefits, who refuse to work. They naively think that these are the types of people that domestic abuse affects, and this is so wrong. I remember when I was little and I used to visit my mum. She went to lots of houses over the years to clean and work for the super rich. One of these couples had a huge home. He was a well-respected businessman in the town where they lived, and his wife was a lovely, quiet woman. But sometimes she wouldn't be seen for weeks, and that's because he would beat the shit out of her. Out of her whole body, her face, her limbs, and she would be black and blue and couldn't face the public. I have sat in on pattern changing courses where the women attending are GPs. They are doctors who treat our children for coughs and colds, yet these women who earn a huge salary are going home and being abused by their husbands. It is that real. It affects members of our society everywhere. It doesn't matter if you're black or white, rich or poor, female or male, a domestic abuser is a domestic abuser, no matter what. And I want to save anyone I can who has been affected by domestic abuse. Right now, in the UK, 20% of children are living with an adult perpetrating domestic abuse. That means that 1 in 5 babies you see running around your school playground is being affected by abuse. That abuse affects them, no matter how much you think it doesn't. Please stay aware, and if you know about a situation of domestic abuse, report it. Ultimately, if you don't, the consequences could be deadly. By speaking up, you might be helping to prevent murder. Don't be frightened to fight for what you believe in. I fight against domestic abuse because it's in me. It's in me to help men, women, and babies who are unable to help themselves without support. But some people don't get it. I have received emails on my page from people saying they don't want to read about domestic abuse because it doesn't interest them, and I have lost hundreds of followers because they don't want to see it. But that's okay. I have learned that I'm still helping and saving, and I would rather have a much smaller platform of people fighting alongside me than a bigger one of people who don't want to change something that's destroying the lives of so many people around us. One person. If you just help one person affected by domestic abuse, that's enough. If you get one woman to safety, if you buy her children some clothes and toys to start again, or if you help a man or woman realise that what they are doing is domestic abuse, then you have achieved more than you could ever have imagined, because to them you will always be their hero, and heroes are what make this world a better place. Chapter 13. Part-time working mummy behind the scenes. Making a difference. Part-time working mummy doesn't just cover domestic abuse. It covers, well, pretty much everything. I speak about taboo things that other people hide away from, and I try and build a community where we can help others and spread positivity. To start with, when I first received negative comments, it would keep me awake at night. Whenever certain newspapers ran one of my posts online, the comments people left on their website about me were horrific, and I would obsess over them. I would sit for hours, getting angry and upset. At times, I would feel so annoyed that I was unable to defend myself against thousands and thousands of horrid, negative comments. But then Josh pointed out that those comments were there under every single article, no matter what the story was about. These people behind their keyboards had nothing better to do than wade in on these articles and write the most evil, disgusting abuse about a total stranger. I also started to realise that every time a post went viral, it disappeared as quickly as it went crazy, and people forget the nasty comments. It took time, but now I don't care if people come on my page and call me a shit mum or a crap wife. Despite sometimes feeling exactly like a shit mum or a crap wife, I try my hardest and I love as hard as I can, which means that I no longer lose sleep over the opinions of people that I don't know. I have also lost people I do know, that I really loved and cared for, some of which are my own family. People sometimes don't like change, and although I tear myself apart with the things I don't and can't have right now, a mortgage, an owned car, holidays abroad, other people look at me like I'm living the high life because of the success the page has brought. They don't see the amount of hard work and hours I put in. They don't see I'm just the same me. I haven't changed. I'm just busier. But it's a good busy. And if my friend or family member was busy doing the things I am, I would ask how I could get involved. I wouldn't turn against them while telling the world they've changed or they don't make time for me. My door is always open to anyone. The only part of my life that's changed is my need to bring about changes for other people, for organisations, which in turn will make this world a better place for our future generations to grow up in. During my therapy sessions, I've explained certain things that people have done or said, people who should love and protect me as I do them, but who instead have gone out to destroy me, and my therapist broke it down so well. She asked me if before the success of the page, these people had tragically died, how would I feel? And I replied, devastated. And her response was, this is no different. The way that they've treated you, the actions they've shown means there's never any going back. They have made things so final by their choices and their behaviour towards you that you're grieving. You are grieving for their loss, the same way a woman grieves for the loss of her husband, whether he tragically dies or he leaves her unexpectedly. A loss is a loss. Those words made so much sense to me. I'm determined to move on and concentrate harder on the people that do love and protect me. Ultimately, people, whether total strangers or close family, can be unkind, but that doesn't mean you have to be unkind back. That is how I believe the world will change, because of more brave people, like us, being kind. The page is now a full-time job, although I have my non-blog job as well. I continue to write about the highs and lows of life. I raise awareness for things that touch me, but more than that, I feel I have been right there while a community has been built, the amazing part-time working mummy crew. I'm so proud and humbled by the amount of support the page has received and the amount of kind, positive people who use it to help others. In March 2017, I was invited to attend the Towergate Award ceremony at the Dorchester Hotel in London. Towergate had named an award after my page, the Part-Time Working Mummy Unsung Hero Award. I had to pick three finalists out of hundreds of nominees for an award to be given to someone who went out of their way for others. My three finalists were A girl who had been bullied throughout school, including suffering a physical attack which led to her having epilepsy so severe that her mum was now her full-time carer. An amazing lady called Hazel, whose house had caught fire due to a faulty fridge and burned to the ground, meaning she had lost all of her possessions. Her daughter suffered horrific burns and her husband died in the blast. And my third finalist was a young boy, aged 14, called Joshua. He had a brother with learning difficulties and his dad had a terminal brain tumour. His mum nominated him, saying that he had no friendship groups as his life was dedicated to helping to care for his brother, sister and father, and he had taken on so much responsibility. The winner was Joshua, who turned out to be the most beautiful, loving boy in the world, a true king who was going through an absolutely horrendous time while trying his best to cope with it by being way ahead of his years. His story was utterly devastating. The ceremony was great and I was hugely honoured to have an award named after the page. It showed how much we had achieved and it was now being properly recognised. Now there were almost 500,000 of us, mums, dads, teenagers, women who struggle to conceive, men who have buried their wives. It's a page for everyone. Recently, we followed the journey of Louise, a mum who wanted to raise awareness of breast cancer. She wanted no funds, just awareness, to stop other little girls like her 6-year-old losing their mummies. A while after we posted our story, Louise's brother contacted me to say that she had passed away. She held on for her daughter's 6th birthday, making it through her party before dying that evening. She also left behind a devastated husband and wider family. The reality of me covering that family story so closely, in such rawness, made me hope that women will check their breasts and if they find a lump, they will go to their GP. It makes me hope that maybe because of this, we will save a life, someone's, somewhere, and so I have to keep going. Bullying. The other topic which had a huge effect on me when I did some research was bullying within schools. I read and watched stories of parents whose children had chosen to commit suicide by putting ropes around their necks or overdosing on tablets. I watched a mother appeal on TV after her beautiful son, Felix, had killed himself after he stepped out in front of a moving train. One morning soon after, Betsy showed me a game on Snapchat called The Letter X. It was a game where you were given a name, then you had to insult that person using the app as much as possible while you remained anonymous. The things I was reading about girls who schooled with Betsy, girls who had come into my home and eaten at our table, were utterly heartbreaking. They were being name-called for having spots, for their weight, for their colour, their dress sense. It went on and on. I decided to write about this and the post spread. Betsy and I were invited onto This Morning to discuss the game and online bullying, and it soon became apparent how huge the problem is. ITV set up the campaign with a hashtag, It's Cool to Be Kind, where children are encouraged to be nice to one another, and I was delighted. I remember being at secondary school and how it felt when people were unkind. I once walked into my English class and someone had written obscenities about me all over the plastic chairs. Everyone was laughing and I wanted to die. They did the same on the bed in the medical room and on the backs of toilet doors. There was a girl in the year above me who seemed to get off on being nasty to people, and I remember finding it odd how she was such a horrid cow but everyone was desperate to be liked by her. She would walk past me and shout, "Pizza face," because I suffered with spots. No matter how much I tried to suck up to her, she just seemed to hate me. There were other girls too who were just nasty. They didn't give a shit who they upset. I don't know why that makes other kids like them more. I suppose it's fear. Back then, it was a relief to go home at night, just to get a break from it all. No one called your house phone to abuse you, so you got a night of peace. You could switch off and worry about it when you woke up for school. Nowadays, you leave the school gates at 3:15 and it worsens. Social media and mobile phones, when used in this way, can destroy our kids' childhoods and it's horrific. They'll be bullied if they don't have a phone, but when they do have one, they constantly see awful things written about them, which means they lose either way and just end up tormented by things they cannot control. I continue to share stories of bullying that distress me and I'm so pleased that I've been made an ambassador for Kidscape. They're an amazing charity on a mission to provide children, families, carers and professionals with advice, training and practical tools to protect young lives. I am working harder to campaign alongside charities to get anti-bullying ambassadors trained up and in every secondary school to tackle this issue. and I want to see a difference. I have two children who are now at this stage of education, and are seeing this daily. I have another three who will be going through it, so I want to know that I have done all I can to make it better in the hope we see kids being nicer to one another, because ultimately, I can't bear to see children committing suicide due to bullying. Every little helps. The hard part of all this for me is that I can't share everything on the page. Some weeks I can get over 1,000 requests to share people's stories and campaigns to raise funds. I get emails from all over the world, from fathers dying of tumours to desperate mums trying to raise funds for their children as they have weeks left to live. I wish I could donate to them all. I wish I could make everyone's lives better and easier, but it's impossible. If I filled my page with campaign after campaign, people would stop reading the content because they also can't help everyone. I have come to the conclusion that it's better to help some people than none, and hopefully the page will inspire others to help people too. But that guilt still sits with me when I read a GoFundMe page and see pictures of a family in torment over a situation they need help with, and I'm unable to help because it's unfair to pick which stories are more important than others. So I donate where I can, and I apologise that I can't do any more, and I just hope that by what little I have done, the world will become a better place. When I came off Facebook at the beginning of February 2016, it was because I had seen what a toxic, horrid place it could be. I had watched total strangers write, like, comment and share statuses and pictures about me, my partner and our children, which caused devastating effects, and I decided that I hated the internet. I hated how it had the power to destroy people's lives with what it could do. Now that I've been running part-time working mummy for a while, my view has changed. Because as much as there are still arseholes posting personal statuses about their ex-partners, as much as there are teenagers playing hideous games on Snapchat to bully other children, there are also huge positives that the internet can bring. This year, we have got women into refuges all over the country. We have bought a little boy a new bike when his was thrown into the river by bullies. We have helped children who were removed from their birth mother on an emergency protection order. We have raised awareness and funds for cancer, domestic violence, baby loss and mental health. That's the power of social media, and what an amazing power it is when it's used in the correct way. Part-time working mummy crew. Since the page began in February 2016, as well as shedding tears for horrid, devastating situations, I have wept tears of joy. I have laughed so much at people's comments, stories and pictures that my stomach hurts, and I have met the most amazing, fun, loving characters along the way that make me see what kind of a world we do live in despite at times questioning it. I have come to realise that when I'm having a shit day, someone else's is worse. We just need to be there for each other. If Josh has been selfish, someone else's husband has been more selfish. If my house is dirty, someone else's is dirtier, and that's the way we work. We make each other feel better publicly. More and more, I get the comments that read, "I have been a silent follower for so long, but I had to comment," and all of those silent followers are met with love, support and advice from other followers. When I sit and read it, I realise that other than my children, this page and the network that we have built is my biggest achievement to date. A real-life part-time working mummy. And I still work part-time. I've remained with the same company that I was with when I was a care support worker. Some women balance working a full-time job and running a family, and there are others who don't want to work again. There is no right or wrong, and it pisses me off when people judge. Ultimately, it's irrelevant if a mother goes out to work full-time, part-time, or stays at home if she's doing what's right for herself, for her children, and for her mental health. But we all struggle at times, and we all wonder about other women. And I think this shows when I reflect on the fact that the most popular question I get asked is, how do you do it? I think that the internet has a way of highlighting the best bits of your life on a blog and covering up the lows, no matter how honest and open you try to be. People much prefer a happy ever after, and it's what everyone is looking for. I am now the happiest I have ever been. I am blessed, as they say, but I still struggle. Some days I get up and nail the housework. I take all five kids out for the day while Josh works. I come home and cook a roast, and he walks in after a 10-hour day at work to me thinking that I'm Superwoman. Then we get the kids bathed and into bed, and we cuddle on the sofa, and I think, if it all went wrong tomorrow, I would be so grateful that I had this. But some days are just an absolute nightmare. Some days, no matter how many times I clean the house, it still looks like a squat. Some days I do everything with a ball of anger in my throat and I get irritated by things that yesterday didn't bother me. Some days I tell the kids to entertain themselves like I had to when I was little because it feels like they only ever want to go out and spend money, and when we're doing that, they're still moaning and clinging to my limbs. Some days when I'm driving to the supermarket, the thought of what to cook for dinner makes me want to cry. Some days, Josh and I fight for absolutely no reason and we don't sit on the sofa together. I go to bed in a mood wanting to argue more and he goes in the lounge with a bird book because he only talks calmly through stuff and refuses to argue. And life is hard. It's hard whether you have 10 kids or none. We have difficult times as a teenager. It's the shittiest, hardest time of your life and no one understands you and everyone hates you. Your parents constantly think you're lying even when you're telling the truth, and you feel like the whole world is against you, even at times your best friends. And then when you're through with that, welcome to adulthood. Being an adult is hard. Having to choose careers, stay afloat, fight off illness, pay bills, and just live each day with all of its struggles. But I think if we were all a bit more honest about how hard it is, it would make it all a bit easier, because more people would admit their struggles. More people would offer support and more people would just be kind. The world would become a nicer place. The worst best times. Sometimes, despite the fact I spend my life fighting the voice in my head that tells me to prepare for a shitstorm because things are going so well, and a lot of time that little voice is actually right, things just work out good. In May 2015, Josh took me to Turkey for my birthday. We split the children between our mums and sisters, thinking it would all work and we could have a relaxing break and go away together. At that point, we were in the throes of family court with both of our ex-partners. Things were hideously tough and we were beyond stressed. We were due to fly out of Exeter late afternoon and Josh wanted to go into the city to get lunch first, which seemed like a good plan. We went to Café Rouge and he told me that he had to nip off as he had booked a haircut. I couldn't understand why he would have booked to get his haircut by a barber he didn't know in a town we didn't live in, when he is the most finicky person in the world about who does his grade two, but never mind. So off he went. I sat in the restaurant for what seemed like ages and eventually I left to have a wander around the shops. It wasn't long before I started panicking as he had been gone way over an hour and we needed to be at the airport soon, but he wasn't picking his phone up. All sorts of scenarios went through my mind, mostly ones where he had died in a tragic accident, but eventually he called me back and we met at the car park. His hair looked no different. The only thing that did look changed was his flustered, red, guilty-looking head. He assured me that he had got his hair cut, just a trim, and we raced to the airport where I had anxiety butterflies in my belly trying to convince myself that he wasn't lying to me but knowing full well that he was. He might not be dead, but I knew he wasn't being truthful. We got to the airport as they were shutting the gate and we made it onto our flight just in time. We arrived in Ulla Dinez to the most beautiful weather and hotel, spending Sunday relaxing by the pool ahead of my birthday the following day. Just before we went for dinner, we decided to call the kids, and I pulled my phone out to find numerous missed calls from my mum. When I called her, she had received a message from Sam to say he was holding on to Edie until I was back in the country. At this point, he had only just begun unsupervised access with her, and hadn't had her overnight for over 9 months. I went into a full-blown panic attack. Josh had never seen me have one, and he started panicking himself, trying to hold me close to him, which was making me panic even more. I threw up all over the hotel room floor. Edie had a set routine at night. She had a doll which she couldn't sleep without, and she needed the label of her comfort blanket in her left palm. She also had a favourite juice cup that she'd chewed a hole in that she always took to bed. Her dad had none of these things. It was all at my house. Edie had never slept away from Tallulah for that length of time, and I was so worried that she would think that I'd abandoned her. I genuinely couldn't calm down. Sam had just moved house, so I had no idea where he lived, and I was going out of my mind. Josh, as usual, was far more rational, reminding me that although we felt Sam was behaving like a bit of a twat, he wasn't a nasty twat or a horrible one. Edie was safe, she would be looked after, and she would adapt until we returned home in 6 days. This sent me even crazier, that he would think that this was all okay. I started screaming at him, 6 days! 6 fucking days. There was no way I could leave my baby in such unfamiliar surroundings for that long. I couldn't eat that night, and I sat in bed repeatedly trying to ring Edie's dad, but he didn't answer. I was sobbing, thinking that she would be crying for us all. The next morning, I woke up and it was my birthday. Josh was so sweet. He'd bought me loads of cute wrap presents that I could use on holiday, like bikinis and flip-flops, and the words in his card were so beautiful. But I was spending every waking minute Googling flights to get us home. Josh said we needed to eat, so we went for breakfast and he told me to go and get on a sun lounger while he went back to get the towels from the room. I just couldn't stop crying. I was trying so hard, but my heart was aching and I felt like the most selfish mother to have ever thought that I could go away and leave the kids and think everything would be okay. When Josh came back, he crouched down beside the sun lounger at my side. I wasn't making any noise, but he could see the tears running from under my glasses down my cheeks, and he just wiped them away with his hand. Kneeling, he pulled out a box from his pocket and said, "Rach, I booked this holiday for us because I wanted to ask you to be my wife, and I thought it was going to be so perfect. I am so, so sorry that it's all gone to shit." I literally couldn't breathe. Not for one second did I think that this was coming. It turned out that the whole time I had convinced myself that he had spent an hour shagging someone else or dying while we were in Exeter, he was running to the jeweller's to try and get the ring. It was, at that time, typical of our lives. He had planned to take me away to propose, thinking it would be the perfect setting, yet I felt heartbroken and was desperate to get back to our babies. As well as the guilt I felt over them, I now had guilt over Josh. I couldn't believe this had happened when he was trying so hard to make me happy. And then I was beyond ecstatic because I was going to be his wife and I felt guilty for feeling happy. It was just the worst, best day of my life. I decided that we had to stay the week. We never usually got a break like this from the kids and Josh was right. No one was dying, nothing was that bad. It could all be dealt with and sorted upon our return. Always fight hard to make a change. It's so easy to hate what has destroyed you and I get it because I've done it. But actually, life becomes so much better when you turn it into something positive. So if your mum was stolen by cancer, go and fundraise and help prevent another mum dying of that fucker of an illness. If you have time, volunteer to help others. The peace of mind you get from helping others is phenomenal, it's addictive, and it's life-changing for the people that you're helping. Trust. Don't let past relationships or shitty situations stop you trusting your current relationship. Try to look at things positively if it's something you can't change. Don't obsess that your partner is shagging about when in fact he or she is doing good things for you. And don't be a bastard because your head takes over due to your heart getting hurt previously. Sometimes we can ruin a really good thing by crazy behaviour that invades genuine happiness. Take time, deep breaths and think properly. Don't panic about something that seems so overwhelmingly devastating when actually, if you just break it down into tiny bits and talk it through with people that support you and work out a plan, it will all level out and you will be just fine. Chapter 14. Our perfectly normal life. We got back from Turkey and life went on. And it has gone on in a way that everyone sees, because I now make it my purpose to let as many women as possible know, through the page, that all of this stuff, the real stuff, is perfectly normal. We're not superhuman. We don't have perfect lives. But if we were all a bit more honest about it, and as supportive as possible, then maybe it wouldn't seem so shitty during the dark times. One day, just before I started writing all of this, at 4 o'clock, Josh popped to the barber's to get his hair cut that didn't need cutting. He returned half an hour later, kicking off that the website states that their shop is open till 6 o'clock. The sign on the door states that they should have been open till 6 o'clock, but they were closed. He told me he felt angry because he had to go bird in at 4:30 in the morning. He wouldn't be home until 7 o'clock at night, so it would leave him no time to get his hair cut that didn't need cutting in the first place. He ended his rant with this beaut of a statement, "I'm so fucked off, it's so annoying. I can't fit in anything for myself because I'm already doing something for myself." I smiled and walked out of the kitchen to the bathroom to take the piss that I desperately needed for the past 35 minutes, but hadn't had a chance to have as I'd had a kid hanging off every limb. On the way, I muttered, loud enough for him to hear, that the only thing he would be needing to do for himself if he carries on being a selfish fuckwit is googling one-bedroom flats on Zoopla. Later that day, I attempted to explain to Seb about girls' hormones and mood swings after he asked why Betsy is always snapping at him. I told him he has all this to come again with Tallulah and then Edie. His response was, "I'm so glad when I get my hormones, I'm only going to get a hairy ball bag and a deep voice. It's gross being a girl. I'd hate to bleed forever and be in a bad mood for the rest of my life." Yep, you've pretty much summed it all up there in one sentence, Sunshine. And here's the proof of it. One night last week, I made Edie homemade lasagna for tea. She spat out the first mouthful and refused to eat the rest. It had bits in. It was too hot. It was spicy. It was yucky. And it was disgusting. The next day, I sent the same lasagna along to her childminder to be reheated in a Tupperware pot. She ate every last bit, and upon swallowing her last mouthful said, "I love your lasagna. Mummy's is disgusting. I don't eat it." That kid. I've got five of these, five tiny turds that I care for full time. It is hard to plan a day out doing something they all enjoy together, all at once, due to the age gaps, and it's harder at times having the day at home trying to entertain them all. I find the key is being organised, and I would love to tell everyone I am, but in reality, a lot of the time I'm not. Seriously though, having multiple kids, you do have to be organised if you can manage it at all. No matter how tired you are at night, make the packed lunches, get the school uniforms out and in piles ready for the next morning, check their bags for letters that need signing, make sure coats and shoes are ready to go, because no matter how much you convince yourself that you will get up an hour earlier the next morning to do it all, you won't. You will hit the snooze button, and then, when you get up, there will be a gang war. Her yellow polo shirt will have disappeared off the face of the earth. You will have run out of ham while doing the packed lunches, and apparently everyone now hates cheese, and you can only find his left school shoe. Everyone will pick up on your stress and start squabbling, which sends you over the edge even more, and by the time you get halfway to school, late, you remember you forgot to feed the fucking dog. It's no wonder he's depressed. It's always better to go to bed with a clear head, knowing it's all ready to get up to, and it always makes for a better day when you wake knowing you don't have to worry about stuff that can ruin the first part of it. But you've also got to remember that you have it hard. It's a full-time job having children, and if you're getting it right most of the time, you really are a miracle worker. You need to get to grips with the fact your house will never be tidy. It may be clean, but it won't be tidy, because trying to have an immaculate home while caring for tiny turds is like shoveling snow when it's still snowing, and the only person that loses is you, because your kids don't care if your windows have mucky prints all over them. The dog couldn't give a shit if the floor smells of Febreze, lavender and chamomile cleaner, and your guests aren't bothered if they have to move a pile of clean laundry to sit on your sofa. The main thing that matters is that your house is full of love, and that's a hard thing to learn, because we'd all love a clean home, we'd all love to be on top of our ironing and have an empty laundry basket, but life is busy and everything could change tomorrow. I've got to the point where I've looked at people I've met through the page who have just been diagnosed with an incurable illness or been left permanently disabled from a car accident, and I think if anything ever happened to me, I would want my children's memories to be filled with me singing stupid songs to them in the bath, losing my shit over who licks the raw eggs and sugar off the wooden spoon when we spend a rainy afternoon burning fairy cakes, and how I woke them up by smelling their toes when they're sleeping at night. I don't want to look back and think that I didn't spend the time with them because I was polishing the sideboard or bleaching the sink. Life is for loving your babies, not cleaning. That goes for step-parenting too. Being a stepmum or a stepdad right now is one of the most common parental roles to have, and it is, without doubt, one of the toughest. In an ideal world, you become a step-parent at a time where your partner's relationship with their ex is amicable, and you slot in. It's happy, you all get along, and everyone's priority is putting the needs of the children first. But in real life, it often doesn't work like this. Step-parents get a tough deal. You're put under the microscope by everyone to do everything right, and the minute someone thinks you're not doing that, you're ripped apart. Yet when you are doing it all right, no one gives you any praise or recognition. If things go smoothly, you will take on the stepchildren and you will get on with your partner's ex. You will work together and the children will love you and you will become a family. But we don't live in a perfect world, and many parents get hurt when someone new becomes part of their children's lives. Rather than work together, they can destroy each other, and quite often these innocent children get destroyed too. Children are capable of loving everyone. The way I've always looked at it is that Edie loves my best friends and Josh's sister. She idolizes them. She gets beyond excited when she sees them.